Welcome to Haldane's Law Matters. Thank you. And today's guest is Bernard Chan, and he's a politician, businessman, a civic leader, and a pivotal figure shaping Hong Kong. Bernard, it's the best I can do, because if I give you all the credits and all your background information, we shall be here for half an hour.
Well, that would be great, right? No, thank you, Jonathan.
But in all seriousness, thank you, first of all, for being here. And it's true that you have a very long curriculum vitae and you have a lot of influence on the city of Hong Kong. And it's fortunate for us that you're here today, because we can launch straight in before we go back to some of your history and matters of that nature with the idea that we're meeting in the most turbulent times.
Wow, no kidding. Not even sure 24 hours ago what I was going to tell you, because things are moving on a daily basis.
Yes, or an hourly basis almost.
Yes.
Thank goodness it was the weekend, Bernard, and we've got a little bit of respite. I looked at the papers today and there was nothing too earth-shattering over the weekend, was there? Or did I miss something?
Well, you never know. So the U.S. administration says something, the president says something, so you can't really tell anymore, which is real.
Yes. It's a world in which we have to evaluate everything and then decide whether it's AI or a human being.
Indeed.
So let's talk about what's going on in the world generally, and then if we may, we'll decide how it's going to affect Hong Kong.
Okay.
Because we can't really influence what's going on in the United States.
Yes, yes. Well, first of all, Jonathan, well, we have our own problem to address, and of course, geopolitics is not helping us either. We've got lots of topics to cover.
We can speak all day.
Yes.
What would you like to start with? I was looking at something at the weekend, which might get it going. It's this, that in the five top President Trump cabinet, I don't know if cabinet's the right expression, administration, I think they call it in America, don't they? They have only two people that have ever been in political posts before. So out of the top five, there's only two. And the two that have, I think I'm right in saying, are J.D. Vance, but it was fairly obscure politically. I don't mean that rudely of him, but he wasn't mainstream. And Marco Rubio, of course. But you've got Peter Hullgrath, who was Fox News and military, Susie Wiles, who's chief of staff, no prior government administration, and of course, Elon Musk, who we know all about.
Well, in fact, Jonathan, since you mentioned that I have served in many different positions in both government and non-governmental jobs, and I can tell you some of my personal take on that. Now, obviously, I can only understand why a lot of people who have not from within, they'll say, well, we want to bring in fresh idea, we want to think out of the box, and we don't want same old, same old. I agree. I mean, I'm from the business sector, so you can only imagine among many of my friends in Hong Kong and so on, they'll say, the government have no idea. They are just too bureaucratic and so on. So they want changes, and they want changes now. Now, the fact that because I've served in so many positions in the past, I kind of understand why things are not moving as quickly as you want to, because there are rules and regulations. And these rules and regulations are there to protect the different interest groups, not just one group, not just the business sector and other groups, right? They are there for a reason. Now, surely, just like in the U.S., you know, the DOGE, right? They want to cut back and eliminate things. So you can say the same about Hong Kong, too. There are lots of bureaucracy, too. But in the past, right, you would think that, well, changes can't happen overnight. You need to be gradual and you got the other stakeholders and so on and so on. But what happened in the U.S. is like overnight now. And I'm pretty sure when they eliminate these sort of jobs, they didn't really think through exactly what measurements, right? And there you go, all the problem. In Hong Kong, similarly, I mean, you could have done that, right? I have many friends in Hong Kong would come up to me and say, wow, why can't we cut the red tape and do this? We did try, actually, but it didn't last very long. You remember that in the 27 years of our return to the mainland, we are tasked to run Hong Kong. And we tried. We have business executive came in to run Hong Kong, held important position. But you may have great idea, but how do you execute them? Many of us don't have no idea. Now, even like me, right, I have served many very important jobs. But at the end, though, I am not the person who execute it.
Mm.
So I came to a conclusion, too, is you can say one thing, but how do you actually get it done is another thing. So you need the civil servant. You need to work with them. And I understand their perspective, why they behave a certain way. There's a reason. It's not like they want to give us a hard time. No, they are doing their jobs too. So the question is, how do you bring in new idea, but yet at the same time, you got to create the buy-in and address every stakeholders. Now, of course, Trump changed all that. Trump overnight decided that, okay, this is how I want to do it. And clearly the whole tariff thing is one example. He came up with this number, I don't know, 85, 125, 145.
Yeah.
But I'm sure at the administrative level nowadays, they might find it very difficult. How do you actually execute it? And that's why you probably see this kind of flip-flop type of things happening, because you can say one thing, but how do you actually deliver them is another thing. It's not as simple as you think. So anyway, I'm just citing this example. Even in Hong Kong, tons of people will tell you that, oh, we could have done this, we couldn't have done that. But then there's always a reason. For example, like Uber, everyone say, why can't we have Uber? Now, Uber, as far as I understand, is not illegal. It's not the Uber issue. It's the car license and the driver's the issue, right? But they're there to make sure that they ask existing stakeholders, self-interest group, and how do you address them? Now, of course, we from the business, we don't care about that problem. You deal with it. Well, then that's the problem. You ask the civil servant to deal with these people who are not happy, right? Then what do you expect them to do? So these are the things that I think too often we come from the business, we seem to think that, wow, just let's do it. But I think when you're running a country, running a city, there are many other interests that you have to address as well, not just your perspective only, right? So I think, but it's amazing to see how Americans and the Trump administration is just, I mean, they completely break the norm.
Yes.
So I have friends in Hong Kong saying, well, maybe we should just follow Trump. Oh yeah, because now who is the moral authority anymore? We used to think the law and order is the moral authority, but now look at what happened in the US. What law and order?
Yes. But that sounds almost like an endorsement.
Not for me.
No.
But I'm just saying, it's interesting that the different perspective. Again, a lot of my friends in Hong Kong in the business saying, well, can we afford to be same old, same old? We should have changes.
Yeah.
I said, and I agree, change is important. We had to adapt the new needs, but we're still bound by these rules. And thank God we have these rules in Hong Kong. I think that's the beauty of the one country, two system.
Yeah.
So I think people, I hope, continue to do business in Hong Kong because they know we are bound by these rules, and rules are not changed overnight.
Yes. In fact, it's arguable, isn't it, that the way in which the Trump administration is tackling this, the wrecking ball that is going through their system, is wrecking their brand name.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know who you're speaking to that endorses it at all, but everyone I know is wholly anti the United States at the moment. Most of them, even the Americans. Even the Americans are pretty ashamed of what's happening. Should they be?
But I do know friends in the U.S. who are still a big supporter of Trump, thinking Trump is doing the right thing as they break away from the same old, same old. Again, as I said in Hong Kong too, we can't afford to remain same old, same old.
Yeah.
But that's different from what the point you're saying is you don't want to wreck the whole system. That's just too much risk because you don't know what you're getting yourself into. So how do we find that right balance while you want to really move on with time because things are changing? We are competing with everyone around you, and like Shenzhen for that matter, right?
Yeah.
So we can't just do the same old. But that's not the same thing as if like, well, let's just break up everything that we have established with good track record.
That sounds right to me. Bernard, I must ask you, would you like the job of chief executive here?
Jonathan, I have served for 20-some years now. If I were to tell you in that 27 years, at this thought of being a chief executive have not crossed my mind, I'll be lying to you, right? Because I mean, many people came and suggest to me before.
I know that a lot of people would like to see you there.
So, but anyway, very evidently today, that's the worst job you can imagine, right? So why would anybody want that job? No, I actually see it's so easy for us to criticize the chief executive of Hong Kong, right? But I have served for 4 chief executives in that 20-some years. I will not say on air who's my preference and so on, but I can just tell you all 4 of them were in difficult position, you know, dealing with very difficult topics and issues. So it is not an easy job, not an easy job at all. And in fact, you think about our last chief executive, Carrie Lam, she was sanctioned, and so is the current chief executive. The sanction, whether it's fair or not fair, but then it's not just the individual, it's the whole family been affected. It's so unfair to them too. But I'm pretty sure they didn't sign up to this, but doesn't matter. These days, sanctions are being weaponized. People use them all the time. Now, of course, tariff is being weaponized.
Yeah.
So you can imagine most people probably from outside, from the business or professional field, will not likely want to be in the government anymore.
Yeah. I mean,
it's not even the job as a chief executive. Even some of the other more high-profile positions, they might want to see themselves being shy away from it, because it's a whole different matter now. You want to serve, you want to contribute, but my gosh, you can...
Consequences are heavy.
Yes. So it's not an easy job. I would not envy anyone. So I actually, I must say that to the current chief executive and all the future one, I have to salute to them for willing to take up this job.
I'm going to take that as a no. I think I won't bother with
it. It's more than a no.
Strong no. By the way, for listeners, which four chief executives did you serve under so that they
know? Mr. C.H. Tong, our first chief executive, he appointed me to the executive council back in 2004. I served under him for unfortunately less than a year because he left the office in the middle of his second term. And then I served under Donald Zhang, a second chief executive. He served a term and a half. So I served half of his first term. And then I got rotated out. And then C.Y. Leung recruited me back. So I served under C.Y. Leung for 5 years. And then, of course, Carrie Lam made me the convener of the executive council. So I served 5 years under her as well. So total of like 14 and a half years. I'm the second longest members on the executive council. Laura Cha have served even longer. She served all four terms of the executive council.
So you really do understand Hong Kong.
Well, I can't say I'm the only person. There are many, but I definitely got a fair share of understanding, especially I'm coming from outside the system. I mean, some people call me a politician, but I still see myself as a businessman. Yes. So, but I have sort of the beauty of understanding what the needs from the business and the professional, but yet at the same time, I work enough hours with politicians and administrators. So I sort of have
an understanding
of how the system work.
And how powerful is a chief executive in Hong Kong? I mean, we see President Trump being all-powerful, frankly, with executive orders and overcoming the courts and the Senate, all-powerful. A British prime minister, less so. Where does a chief executive in Hong Kong sit?
You cannot compare the chief executive of Hong Kong with the rest of the world, but if you look under the Chinese context, it's super powerful. I think this is the only region, or this, in this case, our special administrative regions, that the chief executive have a lot of autonomy to decide on his or her agenda, right?
Yeah.
So it's the financial secretary, right? The financial secretary tasked with the budget and everything. So completely independent from Beijing. Yeah. So in that sense, yes. In fact, now you look back 27 years ago, one country, two system is very much an experiment. And it still remain one, right? But how do you have one country yet two system? Now, I must say, Jonathan, let me just tell you from my own point of view. So when I joined politics by accident 20-some years ago, I was elected to LegCo. I was the youngest elected member at the time, I was 33, and I know so little about politics at the time, like most people from Hong Kong. And now again, let me give you another set of numbers. I would assume that there will be maybe a good one-third people in Hong Kong that never see eye to eyes with China, or maybe not China, with Communist Party of China. And so I suppose whoever is the chief executive or whoever is running China, so long as Communist Party of China, they probably will never trust them, right? And then you probably have another maybe 20%, 25% of people who are very supportive to China. And then you have majority of the rest of them sort of right in the middle who are sort of not really for or not really against. They're happy if their quality of life in Hong Kong continue, good jobs, and more importantly, the certain principle, right? The law and order, corruption-free, these are the basic principles. So long that these are still in place, they're happy. They're not that really into politics, and they don't take sides, right? Now, I bet you a lot of professionals are sort of along the line in the middle, and I include myself in that group too. Definitely, I'm not against, right? The mainland China, no, no way, nor that I'm super, super sympathetic to China either, because I know so little about China at the time, right? So why I tell you this story first, because, well, it's the perspective you start with. So when I joined LegCo, again, I believe there is a one country, two system. Now, again, I suppose if you are that one third who never trust the Chinese to start with, then this whole one country, two system is like, is it for real, right? I suspect they always continuously second-guessing that, oh, China was going to take it back, or they're just fooling us, or something like that, right? And I think majority of the people in the middle, they say, well, actually, things are moving along quite nicely. So they're happy. They're staying on, right? Right? And I think in the beginning of that journey, I think most people, like me, I was like, okay. I never second-guessing that. I never second-guess, is a two system for real or not? I never get second-guess now. And to me is, I make that wrong, this is 27 years ago. At that time, I was naive to think, right? I said, well, and this 50 years unchanged, right? So how long is this two system? 50 years unchanged. So Jonathan, so I add the number up. I was 33, 50 years, I'm 83. So I was like, wow, probably not going to be my problem, right? So what would happen after the 50 years? Probably not my problem and why bother? So I never think about what happened after so-called 50 years, right? Thinking that it was not going to happen in my lifetime likely, right? Anyway, of course, the rest of you now all know the story, what happened, and my gosh. So what happened was we didn't think much about that, the other system. We only care about our own system all along, right? Because we think that this will never happen. But guess what happened? It's not our system is happening. It's what happened to their system. It's amazing. In that last 30, 40 years, China's just come out of the whole economic reform. Everything is just, you know.
Flowering.
Yes. So here comes our problem. So at the turning point, Jonathan, and I think your listener needs to understand it, if they don't already get it, is the turning point of all that is 2003. Do you remember what happened in 2003?
Tell me.
Well, when I mentioned 2003, most people, especially those with the political lens, immediately they'll jump onto this, oh, 500,000 people on the streets, right? I said, no, that's not the turning point. SARS.
Ah.
SARS is the turning point. My son, my second son.
That was 2003.
2003. Yes. So my second son was born 2003 in March. March, things are already happening, but we didn't realize it. By May, Jonathan, you remember my May, this city was like dead. I remember, like, most of the hotels have zero occupancy because nobody figured out what that was. Is it airborne or not, right? People are freaking out, right?
No vaccinations.
Nobody know. What?
We got through it.
Yeah, so 2003, right? Guess what? Our economy just plunged, right? Stock market, property prices, boom, way down. Guess what we did? Mr. Tong went to Beijing and asked for help, right? And what did he ask? He said, can you let in the tourists? Now, so just a reminder to everyone, before 2003, now this is the thing that I always tell whenever I'm outside of Hong Kong promoting Hong Kong, I usually tell people, I said, listen, for most part of the world, no, not every country, especially in the Western economy, I said, when you guys decide to come to Hong Kong, what do you guys have to do? You just buy a ticket, book your hotel, and you come to Hong Kong. You don't need a visa. And if you're from the U.S. and all the Western economies, you got a 90 days visa-free.
You're welcome.
Right? You come here. And guess what? So this is the part that I shock everyone because they didn't realize that. I said, do you realize that the entire 1.3 or 1.4 billion people from China, even today, need a visa to come to Hong Kong? So just to illustrate the point that we have still two systems. It's not like they can freely come here. So not only that, not everyone entitled to apply for a visa, right? It's only until last year that we're now open to 59 cities.
Yes.
So in 2003, what happened was we were begging Beijing to open up. I was told, I wasn't in the room, but I was told initially Beijing was a bit reluctant. It was just, are you sure, are you sure? Because Beijing deliberately, after 1997, keep people away from Hong Kong to honor that two-system thing for different reasons. I don't know exactly. So at 97 time, before 2003, Chinese can only come in Hong Kong with a visa, and there's only a few reasons. Business visa, legitimate reason, or tourist visa, but tourists only in group tour, not individual. And they control the quota, how group tour can come to Hong Kong. Student, far less number at the time. 2003, we asked for open up. So China initially agreed, open up six cities in this region, so-called GBA. It's only until last year, they're up to 59 cities. So I don't know what the number, probably only 300-400 million out of the 1 billion plus people. So not everyone entitled to even apply the visa. And by the way, even if you get the visa from China, maximum 7 days. I talked to my friends in the U.S. I said, you got 90 days. So long you don't work, you stay here 90 days. Everyone from China can only come for 7 days, right? So it's a complete false statement to say, oh, China want to overtake you. No, they don't want to overtake you, right? If they want to, they can do it like overnight, but they don't, right? So anyway, the 2003 is a turning point when, oh, we start to integrate, the word integrate, yeah. Right? So, and from the-
But at Hong Kong's request, that's the point.
That's the point. Now, of course, the biggest mistake, including me, we completely underestimate, you know, the unintended consequence. It started with economic integration.
Yeah.
And then came social integration, right? Before you know it, hey, these people come and buy your home, buy up your prices. And we open up the university. We want to bring in students from China. Well, it turns out they bring in the best students from China competing with ours, right? So a lot of our young people—
And that's heavy competition.
Yeah, and our young people are frustrated because they think that we're letting competition, right? So when I was in Beijing explaining to the Beijing officials, because they asked me, like, why are the young people so upset? So I mentioned about university because their top student came in, even though we only let in 10% on average in each university, but they are really the cream. So they take away jobs, they take away scholarships from our own and so on. And then the Beijing official said to me, oh, you guys, I thought you are an international city. I thought you're faced with competition all the time. So it sounds like you're talking about protectionism. And he reminded me, this official reminded me, he said, look out the window in Beijing. The jobs in Beijing, the universities in Beijing, they are not just for Beijing local residents. It's for the entire China to compete for those jobs. Well, it's true. He is right. But then I don't think I can come back to Hong Kong and tell our students and say, tough luck, you know. But essentially, I think our mistake in a way is that when we let in this so-called integration, we did not do a good enough a job to understand the sentiments. And because we let the supply and demand take charge. And of course, turns out the opposition in Hong Kong nicely take advantage of that. Because already, I tell you, again, we are a good one-third people never really trust China to start with. And then now, they are the opposition at one time. They keep playing that card and saying, you see, slowly, we are compromised now. Jobs have been taken away and they're coming in and taking over this and taking over that. And they try to divide up. I mean, I don't blame them. I think you see politicians everywhere in the world doing the same thing, right? But we, again, I think it's probably my fault as well. We are not sensitive enough. Well, the rest is history now. But my point is, this whole economic and social integration just happened overnight that without we knowing it. Now, there's even though with these two integration, but there's no political integration because of the two systems. Yeah. But again, that's where the problem is. So how to deal with this issue in the past? I tell you, Jonathan, I was an elected member at the time at the National People's Congress in Beijing. I served 15 years. In the middle of that, there was a crisis in Hong Kong at the time. Now, so every year in March, we go to Beijing, and usually we don't go to Beijing. Only the Hong Kong journalists will follow us because the mainland Chinese journalists have no interest in us, except that one incident. So I walk up to the People's Hall, and a whole group of journalists came up to me, and I also then realized that they're not from Hong Kong because they're speaking Putonghua to me. What was the issue? You remember that at the time, there was a milk contamination in China. And so we imposed restrictions on how many cans of milk powder we can bring out of Hong Kong, right? So the main journalist was asking, like, why are we penalizing on them? Why are we this and this and that and that, right? Caught me by surprise. And all of a sudden, I have 20 seconds, right? This is all the cameras on me, right? Live TV. So I'm thinking, okay, I got a problem here. So either I'm going to offend 1.3 billion people, or I'm going to offend my 7 million Hong Kong residents. Whose side are you on, right?
Yeah, definitely the big one.
Well, so I said at the end, I have no choice. I said, sorry, we have nothing against a brother and sister in mainland China, but I have to make sure that the mothers in Hong Kong get access to the milk powder.
Yeah.
Right? I have to say that. What else can I say? But there was a situation because I think for too long, we are almost as like, we are two systems. We have nothing to do with each other. Actually, no. We have a lot to do with each other. But then we didn't prepare for that. Mm. Of course, the rest is history now. I mean, I think so much is going on between the two places. But then, yet, there is no political system. It's almost like, now it's slightly better. But previously, it's almost like, you cross the border of the Shenzhen River. Oh, that's your problem. It's not my problem, right?
Yeah.
But So coming back to your original question about the chief executive, I think maybe in the past, the chief executive is about Hong Kong. But then today, lots of things also have to do with the mainland, especially Greater Bay Area.
Yes.
So you cannot just see from your side. Like, I'm sure the mayor of Shenzhen or the governor or the party secretary, he's also trying to look after the Shenzhen interests. So we are competing, for sure.
Yeah.
But you cannot just simply see them in Trump's narrative. These things were adversary. No, Shenzhen is not our adversary. Of course we compete, but we also cooperate. Right? Where's the water come from? Come on. Right? Where's the food coming from? So we need to be a bit more sensitive. I think before, we lack that sensitivity, both the government and even the average person like myself.
Yeah.
But not so. But that doesn't mean that we are becoming one country. No. No one says no. We still need to be uniquely different. That's what the Beijing official kept reminding us. Hong Kong needs to be in that two system. But you need to respect the one country too.
Yes.
That is not the other system that used to be 40 years ago anymore. Yeah. And so that is a tricky thing, is, you know, how you wear two hats.
You wear two hats. And Bernard, despite the fact that you and I see that there is still two systems very clearly, it's frustrating because the Western press and Western politicians are forever telling their people, their audience, that Hong Kong is now part of mainland China and the two systems has failed. And that is frustrating.
Well, that's why when I go out, I try not to start off with arguing, because it's the whole idea two system thing is so foreign, even for us. I mean, it's so new, right? I can't even say everyone in Hong Kong understands what that means. So I usually start with this thing about the travel visa. I said, so listen, they couldn't understand that. Why you need visa to come to Hong Kong if you're part of the one country, right?
And now I can go into Shenzhen in a fast train in 40 minutes. I don't need a passport. I have my swipe card. Yeah. I walk straight through and I've got 90 days if I want it in mainland China. Yeah. I mean, it's very, very generous.
Oh, by the way, another example I always use, because I don't know if your listener know my background with my Thai connection. I have a strong Thai connection, right? Because my family predominantly based in Bangkok, right?
Yes.
So I go to Bangkok a lot. But guess what? Chinese tourists have visa-free to go to Thailand, right? So they're much easier for them to fly to Bangkok, Phuket, than they come to Hong Kong. Because Hong Kong, you got one shot, 1 year the visa.
Yes, yes. Just talking about your background, I understand, of course, that you have this Thai connection. And I think it was your grandfather that founded Bangkok Bank, wasn't it?
Yes, in 1944, a group of friends.
And you were educated in the United States?
Yes, from after my junior high in Hong Kong, then I went to school in the US.
And I think I'm right in saying you returned to Hong Kong to be involved in Asian financial holdings, is that right?
Sort of. I mean, not right away. I came back to work for another family vehicle initially for 5 years. Then I later joined Asia Financial. Yes.
So what sparked off, do you think, your interest in politics and your wish to be involved in them? What's part of your character that sparked?
Jonathan, at college, I study and I graduate with a studio art degree. I'm a painter. So my interest in politics is zero. No politics. I mean, in fact, I don't think anybody in Hong Kong at that time, right, have any interest in politics. I think the Brits deliberately kept us out from politics. So no, most people just think about making money. It's not about going to politics.
Bernard, I'll just interpose to say that when I first came here in 1978, by the time it had got to 1981, 82, I remember writing home to my parents saying, do you know, one of the nice things about Hong Kong is in the 2 years I've now spent here, I haven't heard the word politics. There are no politics in Hong Kong. It's lovely.
Well, I think the Brits were very smart.
Yeah,
they kept us out from politics and just focused on making money for them. I wasn't interested at all. So I came back. But you know what really changed that entire career path was when my father asked me to go into insurance business, because we have some investment in the insurance company. And he said, hey, nobody in our family knows insurance, because our family are mostly in the banking side. So he said, well, why don't you go to the insurance business? I was somewhat very reluctant in the beginning, because banking at the time, maybe still, but I doubt it anymore. But anyway, at the time, banking has a much more higher profile. Yep. You're a banker versus what, insurance? So it was like, I was a bit reluctant. I feel like, I don't want to go to insurance. I want to be a banker, right? But my dad said, you go in there because we need somebody from the family who understands the business and so on. So I went reluctantly. And in fact, I wasn't even involved in the underwriting side of the business because the company I work for is, in American terms, P&C, property and casualty insurance. In Hong Kong, in the UK terminology, it's general insurance. I mean, my business in general insurance. I wasn't involved in the underwriting side. I was actually more involved in the investment side of the business. So I worked for an insurance company, but I wasn't actually doing insurance. I was doing investment. But amazingly, 2 or 3 years later, and Hong Kong returned to the mainland, and the first time insurance has a seat in the Legislative Council. And at the time, there were already three candidates, or at least three people who have shown interest to run. And they all work for multinational companies. American company, a French company, and a British company. But the numbers are small, right? They came to my boss, not me, I mean, I'm nobody. Right? They came to my boss and said, hey, we must have someone to represent the local interest as well. So they try to convince my boss, but my boss said, listen, I'm too old for this. I know nothing about politics. I'm too old. And then he turned it down. And then as the election coming closer, and he got asked again and again, and somehow he found me sitting like two doors down. He thought, maybe I'm joking. Maybe he said, well, maybe this is the best way to get rid of him from the office. He said to me, he said, why don't you give it a go, right? Since your father sent you to learn about insurance, this is the quickest way to learn insurance. And I said to him, listen, I'm worse than you. Not only that I don't know politics, I actually don't know insurance. Right? So how am I going to represent the entire constituency when I don't know anything? I know about 30 people at a time. And they offer my company. So I know nobody else out there. At the end, I figure, well, what do I get to lose, right? So I ran against three other seniors. And at the end, I won with less than 10 votes, the margins. And I'm pretty, pretty sure it wasn't because of me. It was all about them, that because I'm a nobody, right? It was combination of reasons. But anyway, I was lucky. I got elected. But soon after I got elected, I really panicked because I said, oh my goodness. I am a politician now. What the hell does that mean? And worse is, I still remember this. This is Jonathan. This is the biggest joke. So 2 days after I got elected, I was invited to a talk show just like this, except that this is like on air, live. It's an RTHK live show where their actual caller, for the first time, insurance has a seat in LegCo. So they invited me on this show, live show, to answer questions from anyone who has an issue of insurance. So I was really nervous because I don't think I know enough to answer anything. So I actually brought along an insurance executive from my company, sat next to me. Thank goodness at the time, no live, it's a video thing. So he sat next to me, and as soon as the question was asked, he quickly wrote down the answer for me. It was like,
scribbled a note.
Scribbled a note because I was like, oh my goodness, what am I going to say? So that's how it all started. But the good news was, guess what? The entire Hong Kong people learn along the way too.
Yeah.
Shortly after I got elected, or actually around the same time, we were faced with the first Asian financial crisis. So we were in deficit at the time too, right? So it's all new. We've gone through many crises. And each time, I don't think anyone else actually know better than I do. We're all in the same boat. We're faced with a lot of challenges that nobody know how to deal with in the past. So we'll
face them again now and we'll get over them.
Absolutely. I mean, you think about it. After 27 years, some very good time, and we also went through some crisis, and we overcame each time.
It's the way of things.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode. Stay tuned for next week when we release part two of our fascinating conversation with our guest, Bernard Chan.